Now I'll hand it over to Ustad Ilan, Professor Ilan Pape, who is back in, I believe, London now.
The ability of changing the reality of Palestine, a country deeply connected organically, religiously, culturally, and historically to the Arab world in general, in particular to an area we call the Mashrik, the Eastern Mediterranean, the ability to take such a country and totally change it, convert it into a Jewish European alien political entity within that world, the ability to transform such a reality is not something that only one state can carry out. And as powerful as the Zionist movement was, and as lethal as the Israeli state was after 1948 when it was established, this kind of transformation would not have been able to take place unless it had behind it a very powerful alliance and coalition. And therefore, I would refer in my contribution to the terror of the alliance that enabled the Zionist movement to colonize Palestine, dispossess half of its population, and to commit the current crimes against the Palestinian people that we are witnessing both in the Gaza Strip and in the West Bank. Because I think it's very important to talk about what I usually call global Israel. You can call it global Zionism if you want, because this will explain both the power behind the transformation. And by transformation, I mean the destruction of a country and the dispossession of its people, but also expose the weaknesses of that project and why I believe actually that this project is beginning to see its final days. It is something that people tend to forget that long before any person living in Palestine, whether they were, belong to the Muslim majority or to the sizable Christian minority and the smaller Jewish minority, long before anyone living in Palestine during the 19th century was aware of it, already very powerful people were discussing how to remove them and how to turn their country into something else. And these people, to begin with, were not Jews. They were evangelical Christians. And they held powerful positions, as powerful as the President of the United States, as the President of the American Supreme Court, as Secretary of State of the British Imperial Government, as important policy makers in different levels in the European continent. And they had something in common that either for theological reasons or strategic reasons, they believed that the land they called the Holy Land, which is Palestine, Israel today with the occupied territories, they believed that that land had to be part of the Christian world, of the Western world. And as we moved throughout the 19th century, this more elusive ideas become more focused. And the idea is that not only Palestine should be part of the Western world, a consensus begins to be built both in the United States and in Britain and some other states within the West that Palestine should be part of the British Empire and be ceded from the Ottoman Empire. As you probably know, the Ottomans ruled Palestine for 400 years, from 1517 to 1917. The idea that Palestine should not be part of the Ottoman Empire, in fact, should not be part of the Arab world, should not belong to the Muslim world, from a theological point of view, was connected to an evangelical dogma that saw the Palestine as the ground in which the end of times would eventually materialize. And in order for that plan that included the return of Jesus Christ, the Messiah, the resurrection of the dead, and the beginning of 1,000 years of Christ's rule on the world, and these people took seriously these visions, in order for that to happen, the first step was to return, as they would call it, the Jews to Palestine. So long before Jews in Europe, especially in Eastern and Central Europe, were thinking about colonizing Palestine or settling in Ottoman Palestine, already powerful evangelical Christians were talking about their movement from Europe and the United States to Palestine in order to precipitate the second coming of the Messiah. When it was clear towards the end of the 19th century that the days of the Ottoman Empire are numbered, then began a strategic thinking to evolve that saw the need to turn Palestine into a Jewish state from an imperialist point of view rather than a theological point of view. Palestine as part of a geographical area that in the eyes of the British imperialist was an important land bridge together with Egypt and Iraq on the way to Asia, to British, especially to India, but not only India, to other possessions of the British Empire. These ideas, the theological and strategic one, influenced very much the early Zionist thinkers among the Jewish community, who initially were, their impulse was not to look for settlement in Palestine or colonization of Palestine, but rather looking for a way of dealing with a surge of anti-Semitism and a wish to modernize Jewish life, believing also that a more secular modern Jewish community would be more accepted to the non-Jewish society, and therefore looked for a way of redefining Judaism as nationalism. But the moment they understood that there is a powerful coalition there that would help them to implement the idea of Judaism as nationalism and Jews going out of Europe in order to save themselves from more anti-Semitism, when they realized that there's already a powerful alliance that would help them to build their nationality or new national identity in Palestine, they became hooked themselves on the idea and reorientated anyone else who was in the early Zionist movement towards colonizing Palestine. All this was happening without anyone in Palestine realizing that powerful people, powerful states, powerful religious movements were already discussing the idea of Jews colonizing Palestine. You may ask, did they already understand at the time that colonization would lead to the elimination of the local Palestinians? Well, we have now become much more aware as scholars of something called settler colonialism, the particular kind of colonialist project, which is very similar to the Zionist one, when European powers support movements of European refugees or outcasts or marginal groups and allow them to colonize other parts with their help, but not as proper colonies of the empire. And the difference between imperialist colonization of a place is that the imperial power wanted to exploit the local people, whereas the settler colonial groups, like the Zionist Jews, were more interested in eliminating the local indigenous people. As the late Patrick Wolfe, a great scholar of settler colonialism, said, when it was clear for settlers such as the Zionists, with the help of this international alliance, that there is an indigenous population, a native population, in the country in which they want to rebuild themselves as a European Jewish state, as happened to the white settlers in North America and in Australia, the logic of the elimination of the native emerged. And elimination, in many cases, meant genocide or ethnic cleansing or enclaving people in apartheid systems that happened in South Africa. But again, I want to stress the fact, I'm not trying to absolve the Zionist movement for adopting the elimination as the main methods of turning Palestine into a Jewish state. And Max already gave us some horrific, an entry to some of horrific chapters in this history of elimination. But I want to understand who is complicit in this. And the Palestinians, as it is, were pastoral people with very little impulse to be warriors of any kind. And they were facing not just as Zionist settlers, otherwise you cannot explain why Zionism was so successful, because the Zionists was a small minority when they started ethnically cleansing the Palestinians in the 1920s. They could do it because a mixture of Islamophobia, a mixture of Western supremacy, which Stuart Hall described so well in his article, The West and the Rest, together with strategic interest, targeted the Palestinian as dispensable, as people who could be removed. And that led to the kind of dehumanization that Marx was talking about. But I'm trying to expand it and saying that the dehumanization was not that just Zionists dehumanizing Palestine. The West as a whole, as a powerful structure of politics, economics, and culture, dehumanized, of course, other people as well. But I haven't seen another historical example where the dehumanization was so focused on one particular people. In 1918, 600,000 Palestinians lived in Palestine, and they were targeted very easily as dispensable in order to fulfill all kinds of dreams of Jesus coming back, of the Crusaders coming back, and of Jewish revival. And a solution for anti-Semitism. Moving fast forward, as you all know, Britain led this coalition more or less until 1948, but already, already in 1918, it was very clear that the United States would play a very important role in this international immunity, which I call terror. Because from the Palestinian perspective, this international alliance is terror, is terrorism against them. It's meant to intimidate them, to terrorize them, and eliminate them. A pro-Zionist Jewish lobby emerged in America already in 1918. By the time the Second World War ended, it became already a powerful lobby by itself, joined by a Christian Zionist lobby. And these are lobbies that existed already from, if we look at them today, you can say that they are more than 100 years old, which this longevity explains also their power and the inertia that everybody obeys them, even without their need to exert pressure. Now, if you add to this in modern time, not just the power of the United States, but the interests of multinational cooperation, the high-tech industry, the military industry, the securitization industry, you can see that this global coalition continues. And this time is not just complicit in the elimination itself. Far more important, it's complicit by providing immunity and a shield for the one power that precisely does the elimination itself, which is the state of Israel. And part of this kind of elimination in our time, apart from the horrific genocide that we are witnessing, is trying to suppress and silence any attempt to show this complicity, any attempt to show the essence of Zionism, the dehumanization of Zionism, to protect this charade, fabricated charade and narrative that actually here you have a civilized democratic state that doing self-defense, and the collateral damage is the is the elimination of the Palestinians. And in order to protect that narrative, you want to silence, whether it's to try to silence me in the United States, or to silence Max, or to silence any one of us. And what is so absurd, and with this I will come to a conclusion, what is so absurd that while we are watching daily on our small screen and big screen the genocide in Palestine, this attempt to justify the global coalition that enables that kind of genocide and enabled the genocide before and the ethnic cleansing before, that coalition still works, still is at work despite everything that one can see for themselves and are either surprised or not surprised, I don't know, that still there are young people with modicum of decency in them who would build encampments on university campuses, other people who would go in masses to demonstration, and many of them would be Jews as well as Muslims and Christians. It is still surprising that there is still the sense among those who are part of that global Israel coalition that they can still convey their destructive support for the destruction of the Palestinian through a discourse of democracy, civilization, self-defense, and so on. The gap between the way they talk about the reality and the reality itself has never been wider. And I think that we should tell them that we are thinking about their action as not only immoral, but also as actions of terrorism. And instead of defending ourselves from accusation, as I was accused in Detroit, of supporting terror, I tried to give those who questioned me a short lesson in history, which was not a very good one because I was very tired after 8 years in economy class from London. But as much as I could, I told them, do you think that supporting the Palestinian is supporting terror? Think about what does it mean to support Israel? That is supporting terror. You just got it wrong. Needless to say, that didn't help to shorten the interrogation. It prolonged it. But the point is that we are on the right side of history, and using the right language and expanding the definition of state terror and explaining that Palestine, of course, it's not the only place where it happened, but it epitomizes the hypocrisy and double talk of a case study that is 120 years old, in which with the power of the West, a pastoral people were denied their natural and normal existence. And it's unbelievable that they're still there. It shows their resilience. It shows their solidarity. And this is not because the Arab world was particularly helpful, not because the Muslim world was particularly helpful, not because anyone in the world was particularly helpful. This is because of the particular DNA the Palestinians have in their attachment to the land, attachment to their tradition, to their religion, to the area. But with our help, their efforts in the past will be more successful in the future. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Professor Pape. I think that since we want to keep this within time, we can right away go to Q&A, and I'll go to the first one. Right. Yes, by Steve Byrne. And the question he has is whether the United States or England have special forces who've been operating on the ground in Gaza. Do any of you know?
Somehow I came up on the screen, so I'll take a shot. Well, one of the advantages that the US and UK have is they can sort of obscure their presence through the employment of dual national soldiers who serve in the Israeli military. And we've seen David Cameron, British Foreign Secretary, as well as in a series of State Department briefings, both the State Department and Foreign Ministry, or sorry, Foreign Office of the UK, refuse to say how many of those who are being held captive in Gaza are actually prisoners of war who were British or American citizens who were serving in the Israeli military at the time. There are many now, there have been several British and American citizens who were killed within the Israeli special forces in Gaza. But beyond that, there was a photograph of I believe it was Joe Biden on his first trip to Israel in October when he came to bear hug Netanyahu and forfeit all diplomatic leverage over Israel. And he met with a series of Delta Force team members from an elite international U.S. Special Forces team, which often acts as an assassination squad. They assassinated Pablo Escobar in Colombia, for example. And the White House posted that photo on its Instagram page, and then it disappeared because those soldiers were supposed to be operating in Israel in secret. Their faces and identities were not supposed to be public, and the White House made a giant gaffe there. So we can safely assume that U.S. Special Forces are in Israel, at least in a kind of training capacity. U.S. warships are off the coast of Gaza. The U.S. now has this dubious pier off the coast of Gaza. And in order to offload the aid, they're relying on contractors with military backgrounds, in other words, mercenaries. And there's been discussion of a Biden administration plan for handing over the Rafah crossing, which was seized by the Israeli military about a week and a half ago, to a private mercenary firm, an American firm consisting of former Special Forces soldiers. So I think the stage is set for a scenario in which American, at least former Special Forces soldiers operating through something like a Blackwater type company, could be operating inside Gaza. The only thing stopping them is the armed resistance inside Gaza.
Thanks, Max. So there's a thread within some of the questions about the very, very important topic of U.S.-Israeli relationship. And folks are basically saying that we want to know more about the importance of the lobby, the Israel lobby, and whether it's important to amend the classic Chomskyan framework for understanding that relationship, somewhere between Chomsky's view that it's a strategic asset, Israel is, and Marsheimer's view that it's a strategic liability. So if I'd be wondering what the comments of both of you would be on this.
Well, I spoke last, so I'm happy to go second here if Ilan wants to weigh in.
Yeah, sure. Go ahead. We lost Ilan, but.
Well, I absolutely disagree with Chomsky's analysis there that support for Israel is simply driven by U.S. imperial imperatives and objectives. And we can see that through the scenario in which the U.S. had to essentially defend and mobilize a coalition to defend Israel from an Iranian retaliation that was driven by the brazen and insane behavior of Israel attacking Iran's consular facilities in Damascus deliberately. I mean, remember, and this we're almost at the, I think, 20th anniversary of the U.S., 30th anniversary of the U.S. attacking deliberately the Chinese embassy in Belgrade. But the U.S. apologized for that. It tried to deny it at first, lied about it. Israel just brazenly attacks another country's sovereign territory in order to drag the U.S. into a war with Iran that the U.S. clearly does not want. The U.S. clearly doesn't want it. The U.S. might want to see Iran be weakened, destroyed from within through sanctions. But as we saw after the killing of Qasem Soleimani, a military campaign that brings the U.S. head-to-head with Iran might be too damaging for U.S. imperial interests across the Middle East, particularly Jordan. We can also see the fraying of the Camp David Accords through the anger and ire that's expressed by Egypt over Israel attempting to go into Rafah. and putting so much pressure on Egyptian borders. There's so many, it's becoming so obvious that U.S. imperial interests are hindered by what Israel's seeking to do. The U.S. wants to pivot to Asia right now. It replaced Victoria Nuland, the architect of the Ukraine coup, with Kurt Campbell, who helped author Obama's pivot to Asia. It doesn't really want to be engaged right now. And if there truly was a deep and abiding imperial U.S. interest in supporting Israel's mad dog policies to the hilt, it wouldn't require the Israel lobby to be doing what it's doing right now. Certainly there wouldn't, if there was a moral case, that wouldn't be taking place. So the Washington Post, of all places, published one of the most compelling investigations of the Israel lobby that we've seen in recent times. It gained access to a WhatsApp group. It almost sounds like I'm describing some anti-Semitic fantasy. This WhatsApp chat group contained over 50 Zionist billionaires in the U.S. One of them, who's very notable, Bill Ackman, helped pay for the counter protests that led to a violent mob assault on student protesters at UCLA. He oversaw the ousting of Harvard's president because she refused to ban Students for Justice in Palestine. And what this Zionist billionaire cabal, if it really is a cabal, was doing was they were offering legal bribes to New York City Mayor Eric Adams and offering successfully to pay for private intelligence operations in order to get Eric Adams to send the New York Police Department to attack and destroy the Columbia University encampment. This is just such an ugly period for the Democratic Party and for liberalism in general. They're relying heavily on a Zionist billionaire class. One third of Biden's donors, who donated close to $1 million to his victory fund, are pro-Israel operatives. And yet they have to cater to this group of operatives at the expense of their own base. Joe Biden is losing a substantial portion of his base, particularly people under 35, because he has to cater not only to this Zionist billionaire class, but to Israel itself, because they're essentially cutouts of Israeli intelligence. Many of them have close ties to Israeli intelligence and are dual Israeli citizens, like Haim Saban or Miriam Adelson, who is one of the top donors to the Republican Party on behalf of her late husband, Sheldon. So we're witnessing U.S. politics being destabilized by the cutouts of this foreign entity. And it doesn't really back up the thesis that Israel and the U.S. have the same shared interests and goals. And I should also mention the contradictions within American nationalism are beginning to play out within the MAGA movement, the pro-Trump movement, in which two of its top influencers have jumped ship, Candace Owens and Tucker Carlson, and are now in open opposition to Israel's assault on Gaza. Candace Owens hosted Norman Finkelstein on her show, which led to her ouster by her boss, the Zionist propagandist Ben Shapiro. And Tucker Carlson has faced harsh political recriminations for hosting an evangelical pastor from Bethlehem, the Palestinian Reverend Munter Isaac, on his show, in which for 45 minutes they shredded the essential logic of Zionism. This is because they don't see American nationalism or the concept of America first as lining up with the Israel first policy advanced by both Biden and Donald Trump and their donor class.
Right. Thanks, Max. The one additional point that I would ask you about is if the lobby existed, which it does exist, but if the military-industrial complex was not there also seeking reaping profits from this. So it does seem like they are more or less doing this in tandem, and it works out for both of them. So the question is, how long can that framework sustain this relationship? When, when I talk to people, many people will say within that kind of permanent unelected bureaucracy of the military intelligence apparatus, the national security state, many folks within that architecture would disagree with what the United States is doing and put forward that argument that this is incredibly damaging for the image of the United States in the world.
Well, certainly there are U.S. imperial interests being advanced, and the U.S. also does reap benefits. The U.S. elite reaps benefits from the $35 billion just advanced to Israel. A lot of that will go straight back to the defense industry in the U.S. and pay for new McMansions in the U.S. suburbs for executives and contractors. I mean, the economy here in Washington, D.C. is heavily fueled by that kind of corporate welfare. But much of that money is going to Ukraine already and other countries. It's not as though U.S. empire or that class would collapse if Israel ceased to exist as the regional bully. When I look back to the immediate days after 9/11, when Donald Kagan, a neocon intellectual, father of Robert Kagan, who advised both Bush, Republican Mitt Romney, and Hillary Clinton, the husband of Victoria Nuland, who was Assistant Secretary of State under Biden, immediately blamed Palestinians for the 9/11 attacks 2 days after 9/11. In the days after 9/11, we saw footage nonstop on U.S. media of Palestinian youth celebrating the attacks in Ramallah. Howard Stern, the shock jock propagandist, blamed Palestinians as the attack was taking place. There was just this reflexive urge to blame Palestinians. Ariel Sharon whispered in George W. Bush's ear, Yasser Arafat is our bin Laden. And there was clear Israeli influence on everything the U.S. did, maybe outside of Afghanistan after 9/11, the Iraq war. Benjamin Netanyahu came to testify to the Senate that Saddam absolutely had WMD. The Israelis pushed the red line policy on Syria on chemical weapons, leading to driving various chemical attack, false flag hoaxes and staged events like the one in Douma in Syria in April 2018. Muammar Gaddafi absolutely was a target of Israel. Gaddafi was the first person to make the case for one state solution in the New York Times, was a supporter of Palestinian resistance. And the U.S. waged dirty wars, regime change operations, and direct wars on all of these countries, leading to regional destabilization. Did it benefit U.S. empire? That is, it doesn't seem as though it did. It seems to have benefited Iran as well as Russia, which consolidated a partial hold over Syria. And while these countries were substantially weakened, they were, you know, powerful sovereign, or they had some power as sovereign Arab states, independent states, which at least rhetorically opposed Zionism. It hasn't worked out well for U.S. empire. Thousands and thousands of Christian American soldiers were killed in these wars, fomenting anger across Middle America. One of the thesis of the management of savagery was how my book was that these wars led to the rise of Donald Trump and Trumpism, which I think Trumpism will ultimately weaken American empire and certainly eliminates American soft power, its selling point of liberalism and the marketing of America as a shining city on the hill. So I'm taking up too much time here, but I just think that the thesis of Mearsheimer has really won out in the post-October 7 era.
Yeah, no, certainly it seems that way. Professor Pape, obviously you've just written a book about the influence of the lobby, both in, I think, the UK and in the United States. So my question for you would be the same. I mean, how determinative is the role of the lobby in the United States in shaping the American policy towards Israel-Palestine? And as you mentioned before, we have a conception of what that lobby is. But would we also include Christian Zionism, which is obviously a huge phenomena in the United States, as part of the lobby, or at least as part of those forces that are compelling the United States to behave this way?
Well, certainly the lobby is crucial for forming American policy towards Israel and Palestine. But it's a different question. Is it crucial in its influence on American policy towards the Arab world, the Muslim world, or the world at large? And there, I think the answer is more complicated. Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. In fact, I think for generations, administrations had a kind of an agreement with the lobby, especially with AIPAC, which only was violated during the last 10 years, that the pro-Israeli or pro-Zionist lobby interferes less in American policy in the region, provided American policy towards Israel is on the right tracks, so to speak. There was even almost an unwritten agreement with President Ford on such a. There was a formula. You give us a carte blanche to everything we do in Palestine, and we try not to interfere with you the way you are pursuing your policies in the Arab world. Because after all, what's the 7th of October has exposed is that Israel is not such a huge economic bonanza. And you can sell arms to Saudi Arabia and probably get more money from the money you will get from Israel, and you won't. And it would be much less complicated military arrangement. So I think in that respect, the power of the lobby and also the weakness of the lobby is that it is totally focused, to my mind, it's totally focused on giving a carte blanche to Israel to do whatever it wants, especially towards the Palestinians. And sometimes part of that carte blanche or the demand for carte blanche is also influencing the way Israel wants American policy to develop towards Syria, Iraq, and so on. But I think it's a far more marginal issue. Now, what I think is important is that the lobby has two weaknesses. One, it works by inertia. And because it works by inertia, it assumes, and I think with the present generation of American politicians, it might be right. I'm not sure whether this would be right with the younger generation, that it doesn't have to do much work anymore because, you know, the DNA of an American politician is to abide or to stand, as they would put it, by Israel without any need for the lobby to intervene. There were, I think, for the first time, although there were some individuals, but for the first time, there are, first of all, faced with a group of American politicians, not just an individual here and there, that their perspective on politics and especially on foreign policy is one in which Israel is the pariah state. Israel is the criminal state. Define it as you wish. And therefore, this and all the methodologies that are at AIPAC's disposal are irrelevant when they're dealing with people, especially young American politicians, with that kind of moral view about politics. So that's one weakness, that they don't have the tools to deal with a possible transformation, not of all the American politicians, of course not, but with a sizable group of young aspiring politicians who might bring a different kind of perspective towards the developments in Palestine. The second weakness, which I think is very important, is that the way Israel develops, and I have little doubt that Israel is moving into a very clear period in which the messianic right wing is going to take over Israeli politics, the security services, the army. We are moving into a kind of Israel that would be very difficult to be defended and justified, even for people who, you know, for years supported Israel. And the lobby would find itself defending an Israel that is very different from the Israel it defended in the last 76 years. Of course, that Israel did terrible things as well, but it was able to commodify itself as a country in which there are diversity of opinions. There's also a liberal peace camp, even a socialist peace camp. All this is going out of the window now. And again, I don't think the lobby has the ability to defend that kind of Israel. As I say, it is facing a different kind of generational view, including among Jews in America, that we should not take a teleological determinist view about the power of that lobby. I think its weakening is part of many other indications that the Zionist project is coming to its last days.
Wonderful. Just two final questions, but I was going to say that it also seems very clear that the lobby or Israel will no longer be able to create another lobby which is as Zionist as they have in the past. I think this, what Max referred to, a new generation of younger Jews, that they will find, I think, it much more difficult for them to be as Zionist as they have been in the past. So I think that's one factor. But the last two questions for you both. Max, the issue that many people have brought up is what you've also been speaking very powerfully on, is are the mass student uprisings and the way that university administrations egged on by Congress have responded to them. I think people know what's going on there, although you can kind of remind us of some of the worst aspects of it, but also its larger meaning. As you say, it's the unmasking of all of the elite institutions. I think people are really interested in what you your take is on that.
Sorry, I was having a technical issue there. Well, really quickly, I mean, what the students are doing is filling the moral void, which has been left by our entire political class, which are controlled by a repugnant donor class that I already discussed. And they're being punished for it by administrations that are controlled in the same way. And in doing so, they're unmasking academia, the campus, what it truly means. The idea of how our elite interpret the First Amendment, it's not something to be protected if it actually threatens their hold on power. And they're exposing Zionist control, Zionist influence over these institutions, where in a way in which core American values are to be sacrificed in order to protect the special relationship with an apartheid colony 5,000 miles away called Israel. It's completely infuriating to watch. And I think the most illustrative scenario took place in Los Angeles, in West Los Angeles, in UCLA, where the infrastructure for a kind of counter protest of just raw hate, which was filled with many Israeli army veterans, Israeli expats in LA, along with Jewish Iranians, and various thugs and hooligans, was erected by the Israel American Council, a powerful Israel lobby group which paid for speaker systems to blast the noises of babies screaming at peaceful student demonstrators who had created a Gaza encampment, to play hours on end of atrocity footage or alleged atrocity footage from October 7th, and then to allow a mob of hooligans to attack those peaceful student demonstrators on camera. It was live streamed on LA local news. Everyone was watching it. Various Zionist thugs committed multiple acts of assault and battery on camera, and no one has been arrested. And I think it's clear. Even the New York Times acknowledged this in a report. Political influence has given those attackers impunity in the same way that political influence has given the thugs of Itamar Ben-Gvir, who are now allowed to wear army uniforms and are armed with US M4 carbines provided by the United States, impunity to carry out terror across the West Bank. So the occupation has come home, and its target are the Americans who have the humanity and the morality and the conscience to put their convictions on the line in these encampments on campuses. And I think this will go to Chicago, to the Democratic Convention, and it will be one of the biggest tests the Democratic Party has faced since 1968.
Great. Thanks for that, Max. And finally, for Professor Pape, a lot of folks have now heard you speaking about this being essentially the last phase of the Zionist project. And folks are really interested, in understanding what are those indicators that you believe are part and parcel of this end of this project.
Yeah. First of all, I talk about the beginning of the end, and that is important because historically beginning can be a long period. Not only a long period, but also a very dangerous period, because regimes that feel insecure and realize themselves that are under the danger of collapse and disintegration are losing any inhibitions, if they ever had some inhibitions before, in using force and lethal force in order to survive. So the bad news is that because it is the beginning of the end, the very near future holds a lot of dangers, especially to the Palestinians, as I think the next Israeli project after Gaza is the West Bank. And I'm very apprehensive of what Israel is going to do there in the very near future. However, looking a bit into a more distant future, you can see indicators that are discrete and seem to be disconnected at this moment in time, but I think they might fuse together into a very powerful transformative event that would change the reality in Palestine. One indicator is the implosion of the Israeli Jewish society from within. It seems that the whole idea of Judaism as nationalism is not working. There is little common ground between Israeli who see themselves as seculars, liberal, Western, if you want, and the Israelis who see themselves as religious, messianic, and believe in Israel, that Israel should be a Jewish theocracy. They found in the past a common enemy, the Palestinians of the Arab world, but it seems, and the 7th of October has proved that, that external danger, as they saw it, fails to unite them anymore. So I cannot see any where would they find the cement to hold them together if even the fear from the Palestinians or the neighboring Arab state is not working to unite them. So that's one indicator. A second indicator is the collapse of the Israeli economy. For years, Israel was applauded for being one of the most successful economic system in the OECD. But in the last 7 months, we have seen that this macroeconomical approach covered up for a microeconomic reality by which the gap between the rich and the poor is getting wider by the day. Israel, without American financial assistance, find it very difficult to provide basic needs and basic infrastructure. And the worst thing that happens from an Israeli economic perspective is that the economic elite has already decided to invest its capital outside of Israel. Some even followed the investment and relocated themselves. This is an inevitable development, because there's no chance for peace or reconciliation in the next 10 or 20 years. So this drain of money and the people who are making the money will continue. A third indicator is the growing isolation of Israel. It's making of a pariah state the beginning of the possibility that people are moving from actions of civil society, of boycott and divestment, to actions of government, to sanctions. The fact that the younger Jewish generation is deserting Zionism, and many of them are supporting the solidarity movement with the Palestinians, is another indicator. And the fact that the whole area around Israel is moving into a very revolutionary period, which challenges the political structure that was built during the colonialist, during the end of the First World War by the colonial powers, Britain and France, which challenges the Westphalian nation state idea. So there's a whole regional transformation that will affect very much the existence of a Jewish state, a racist Jewish state. And finally, While the national Palestinian movement at this very moment is disunited, fragmented, there is a new energy among younger Palestinians, and this is one of the youngest societies in the world, to rebuild an organization that is far more consensual, far more comprehensive, and therefore I think will be far more effective in contributing to the collapse of the Zionist project, and hopefully will also suggest, which it doesn't now, what should replace it. And so I think you take all these indicators, some others I don't have time to explore, you can see as a scholar, not just as an activist, huge cracks in the building, and I think they are not amendable.
It's great to see you again, Ilan. We first met a few years ago, and I guess it was at a different time, so you were able to just cruise on into the United States. Ilan Pappe's book, The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine, was a formative read for me. It really helped reinforce my understanding of Zionism and of the Israel-Palestine crisis, and couldn't recommend it more as a primer for everyone watching. I mean, if there's one book to read now, it's that. Because what Israel is attempting to do is to finish 1948. What they began, it's been an unfinished project against massive resistance, including resistance from many of you who are tuning in right now. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot to say about state terror, including American state terror, the kind of dirty warfare tactics that I describe in my book, The Management of Savagery, that Junaid mentioned. But I want to kind of just focus, at least my initial remarks, on Gaza, on what Israel has been doing to Gaza, on trying to understand kind of the broader outlines of the policy. And I think Ilan might be able to help fill in a lot of the broader outlines with historic details. I think to help you understand my thinking on Gaza, I would start actually in the pre-state era of Zionism. As the Zionist colonial project was taking hold in places like Jaffa, for example, where there was a robust industry of shipping, orange groves, and Zionists began buying up the land. The Histadrut, the main labor union of labor Zionism, then controlled by David Ben-Gurion, who would go on to become the first prime minister of Israel, would initiate boycotts of Jewish businesses that employed Palestinians as cheap labor, and they would go and attack those businesses. They'd burn them down. And many of those businesses were run actually by revisionist Zionists, the disciples of Zeb Jabotinsky, the political antecedents of the Likud party, which Benjamin Netanyahu now leads. So those who were actually the architects, ideological architects of liberal Zionism, were campaigning for what in Hebrew is known as hafradah, or separation, apartheid, segregation, while the revisionists were actually content to exploit Arab labor. This will help us to understand the siege policy on Gaza and the broader policy towards the violent demographic engineering of a ostensibly Jewish majority, quote unquote, Jewish state. Now, after the Nakba was completed, and I'll spare you the history of that. Ilan is the expert here, but state terror was obviously employed in order to guarantee the expulsion of 750,000 Palestinians. The Israeli state, which was completely controlled by the labor movement, those considered in the West to be the liberals or to the left of center, placed a human wall around the Gaza Strip in an area now known as the Gaza Envelope. And they began erecting kibbutzim, these kind of Jews-only socialist communities, which were supplemented by moshavim, which were cooperative communities, also Jews-only. And they tilled the land, but they basically served as a means of hemming in the population of the Gaza Strip, who were the former residents of this area, this vast area all across southern Israel all the way up to Tel Aviv and what became Tel Aviv. Many of them actually came from Jaffa. So they were surplus humanity who had to be held in this human warehouse of Gaza. There were not walls yet around the Gaza Strip. Some barbed wire was going up. And every once in a while, there would be Fedayeen attacks on the kibbutzim, which had stolen their land. A guard was killed in, I believe, 1953, named Roy Rotenberg, a kibbutz guard. And Moshe Dayan, chief of staff of the Israeli army, delivered a speech at that time that I think is seminal in understanding the colonialism that's at the base of Zionism. He said that in his eulogy for this guard who was killed, we cannot plant a tree or till a field or build a house without the cannon, the machine gun, or the steel helmet. And that really is the essence of Zionist settler colonialism. So hard separation was always the goal of the labor movement that dominated early Zionism and Israel throughout much of its history. I mean, this goes all the way through the First Intifada, which employed state terror tactics like the broken bones policy that Yitzhak Rabin directed, in which Palestinian stone throwers, young men, had their arms broken by the military. But Palestinians were still able to cross into 1948 Israel to serve as cheap labor. And Yitzhak Rabin, the most visible figure, the hero of labor Zionism, of modern labor Zionism, campaigned in 1992 on getting Gaza out of Tel Aviv. That was one of his campaign slogans. He declared that he wished that Gaza would simply sink into the sea and disappear. But what he meant was get all the Palestinian laborers out of Tel Aviv, make Palestinians disappear. That was the point of the Oslo Accords that Rabin oversaw. And along with his labor minister, Haim Ramon, in the late 90s, Rabin and Ramon were already drawing out the outlines for the apartheid wall that would separate Palestinians from the West Bank from the majority of Jews who lived in quote-unquote Israel proper, which was to include the major settlement blocks like Ariel and Male Adumim. For Palestinians, obviously this was unacceptable. When Ariel Sharon rose to power, he began a policy of provoking the Palestinians into violence in order to achieve goals of further ethnic cleansing and separation, starting with his provocative visit to the Al-Aqsa compound. But then 1 million bullets in October, actually this preceded Sharon, in the Ehud Barak administration, the Israeli military fired 1 million bullets at Palestinian protesters at the dawn of the Second Intifada. It was part of a push policy to push them towards violence through state terror. And the violence did come. It came in the form of suicide bombing. It came in the form of armed resistance in the occupied territories, attacks on settlers. The liberal publication Haaretz, the voice of the enlightened public of Israel, declared that we are in a war for coffee and croissants in the morning. In other words, to preserve what Labor Party Prime Minister Ehud Barak called a villa in the jungle. That was how he described Israel, a villa in the jungle, in straightforward colonial language. Israel was to enjoy a European lifestyle, particularly in Tel Aviv and South Jerusalem. And the Palestinians were going to have to disappear at some point. So this led to, first of all, the construction of the apartheid wall in and around the West Bank, but also the siege policy of Gaza to construct kind of a cordon sanitaire around Gaza. And to necessitate that, Israel evacuated some 9,000 settlers, fanatics from Gush Katif, and got the praise of liberal Zionists and left Zionists like David Grossman, who actually said that Ariel Sharon, the bulldozer, as he was praised by Joe Biden at his funeral, might actually be a man of peace because he carried out this disengagement. What they didn't understand was that, as the director of the Shin Bet at the time, Avi Dichter, said, the point of the disengagement was to give Israeli forces greater freedom of operation in the Gaza Strip. This meant that they could actually start to treat the Gaza Strip as the United States treated Afghanistan, as an open war zone that could be targeted with F-16 attack jets, tank shells. Wouldn't just be the usual kind of special forces operation and bulldozing just one, you know, one specific area like the Jenin refugee camp. Entire neighborhoods and cities could eventually be leveled. Academics were brought in from the labor Zionist wing of the Zionist movement to help devise this siege. One was Arnon Sofer, a demographer from, I believe, Tel Aviv University, who said that in order for us to survive, we will have to kill and kill and kill all day, every day, because the pressure at the borders in Gaza will become enormous. And what he meant to say is, if we leave and start to treat Gaza as a war zone, resistance will flourish there and we will have to crush it by mass killing every day. In order to create a legal justification for that policy, the policy of dropping 500 and 2,000 pound bombs in Gaza, deliberately killing civilians, academics like Asa Kasher from Tel Aviv University and former military intelligence operative Amos Yadlin devised the neighbor policy, the idea that the Geneva Conventions was irrelevant and that the what they called the terrorist's non-dangerous neighbor could also be killed. This was a policy they freely introduced, as I said, in order to subvert the Geneva Conventions and make children and women legal targets simply because they live next door to the so-called terrorist. And as we now see, the terrorist is anyone who is defined as having an affiliation with Hamas, meaning they could be working for some municipal authority as a plumber, but as long as they work under the rubric of Hamas, they're a target. So essentially, they created the legal justification out of Tel Aviv University for genocide. This came to be known as the Dahiya Doctrine after Israel leveled the southern Beirut neighborhood of Dahiya, which they labeled a stronghold for Hezbollah during the 2006 invasion and assault on Lebanon, which was a failed attempt to dislodge Hezbollah and permanently push them beyond the Litani River. This was a failed operation, but it created, under the watch of Gadi Eisenkot, again, another figure from the Labor Party in Israel, who is then the Israeli Army Chief of Staff, and who is currently in the war cabinet with Netanyahu, someone who's a preferred choice of the Americans in the Biden administration. They created a formalized state terror doctrine in which civilians would be attacked, neighborhoods would be leveled, entire cities would be destroyed in order to pressure the civilian population into turning against resistance because they would be so demoralized. And under this delusional Israeli stratagem, they believed that the Lebanese people, and particularly the Lebanese Shia, would turn against Hassan Nasrallah. They soon applied this doctrine to the Palestinians of Gaza in 2008-2009 with Operation Cast Lead, then Operation Pillar of Cloud 2011, then in 2014, the war that I witnessed, that I wrote about in my book, The 51-Day War, and the documentary I co-produced, Killing Gaza, Operation Protective Edge. And after that operation, I testified at the Russell Tribunal. It was a people's tribunal in Brussels. And I was asked the question, which all presenters were asked, had Israel committed genocide in this 2014 assault, which I witnessed on the Gaza Strip? And I said, well, I can't conclude that they committed genocide, even though I walked through the rubble of essentially entire cities from Shujaia to Beit Hanun, the entire frontier region that were completely destroyed. While they hadn't committed genocide, Israel was primed for genocide. it was primed to commit genocide because of the that it had already established the legal justification for doing so. It already had the diplomatic support from the United States and Brussels to do so. It already had the weapons to do so. And also, it had the collective psyche embedded in its population to do so. Because by that time, and by the time I was writing my book, Goliath, which came out in 2013, where I spent so much time inside Jewish-Israeli society, the Palestinian, through the policy of hard separation, of Hafradah, through the siege of Gaza and the walling off of the West Bank, had essentially disappeared. And they became nothing more than the specter of a terrorist, someone who is encountered by young Israelis only as digitized images on a drone screen, whose lives could be flicked off with the switch, with could be switched off with the flick of a joystick button. They had essentially been reduced to what the Italian philosopher Giorgio Agamben called bare life, who existed in a state of legal exception, which is the sort of the essence of life under a fascist genocidal regime. They had been reduced to what the Harvard historian or former historian at Harvard and disciple of the late Orientalist Bernard Lewis, someone named Martin Kramer, referred to as superfluous young men. And so the policy always was pointing towards genocide. Israel was primed for genocide long ago. The Zionist project was always leading us to this direction. And now it has the technology through the Lavender AI system to conduct targeting for genocide at a rate so fast that humans cannot even process it. And the Israeli military is struggling to keep up with this dystopian Skynet-like system, which devises targets so rapidly that they cannot conduct genocide quickly enough, but they can be sure through President Joe Biden and the people who control him, like Tony Blinken, that they'll have the weapons to do so. Biden just authorized $700 million in new tank shells for the Israeli military because they keep running out. Really quickly, to conclude, this policy of state terror, separation, this dystopian policy of the Zionist project carried out by the Israeli regime does not only target Palestinians, Palestinian Muslims and Christians. As we've seen through the Hannibal Directive, Jews, particularly Jewish Israelis, can be a target as well. When the melee ensued on October 7th and Palestinian militants began capturing Jewish Israelis, either at a music festival or in the kibbutzim that had been established as a human wall or in the army bases that were embedded within the kibbutzim and which used the kibbutz residents as human shields, when they came under attack, Israel enacted the Hannibal Directive, once a secret and scandalous directive that allows the military to kill Jewish Israeli citizens and Israeli soldiers if they are held hostage or taken captive in order to deny Palestinian militant factions political leverage that they exercise to exchange them for the hundreds and thousands of Palestinian captives and hostages who are in Israeli prisons. And when we wrote about it, this at the Gray Zone and demonstrated that Apache helicopters were in the air on October 7th, targeting anything on the ground, but particularly vehicles heading back into Gaza, knowingly targeting Jewish Israelis. When tanks were operating in the kibbutzim, knowingly targeting Jewish Israelis because they were held hostage in order to avoid negotiations. I was called a master manipulator by who? By Haaretz, which later confirmed that this policy had been enacted. So when you dehumanize your enemy so much, you begin to dehumanize your own population in order to advance the Machiavellian objectives of your mafia-like elite. And that now extends on a global level. I see the Hannibal Directive being extended to Jews internationally, because the Zionist movement has always identified the Jewish diaspora as a threat to its own existence. If we Jews flourish in the diaspora, as we're doing in the United States, where we continue to enjoy a golden age, it negates the very justification for Zionism. And so we are now being met with a manufactured panic about a surge in anti-Semitism, with pro-Israel, Israel lobby operatives from campuses being trotted out to deliver press conferences, to inventing hate crimes against themselves, falsifying anti-Semitic hate crimes to place Jews in a state of complete panic. And at the same time, weaponizing the Holocaust and Jewish historical persecution, the history of anti-Semitism, as tools of mass repression to ram through bills like the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act, which was just passed by a majority in Congress, a vast majority, mostly Gentile members of Congress, which declares that trenchant criticism, including accusing Israel of being an apartheid state, is anti-Semitic, and that the Department of Education in the United States must adopt this definition. This definition defines me and Ilan Pappe as anti-Semites, along with a full one-third of all American Jews under the age of 40 who believe correctly that Israel is committing genocide in Gaza. That's what they recently told pollsters. And I think it's this weaponization of anti-Semitism which places Jews in peril around the world, which creates divisions between them and the majority population in which they live, and which deliberately aims to destroy the Jewish diaspora. And it's this weaponization policy which has led to the targeting of Jews who refuse to accept the dehumanization and genocide of Palestinians, like Ilan Pappe, and has sicked the security services all across the West on them. So I'll look forward to hearing more about what actually happened in Detroit, but also to hearing Ilan's analysis of how we got here. And I thank you all for giving me the mic.
Thanks so much, Max. We learned a lot there, and I think a lot of questions, at least within me, have arisen, which hopefully we can cover in the Q&A session.